This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Great Lakes Echo commentator Gary Wilson shares his thoughts on Great Lakes policy under a Donald Trump administration. But first, Western Michigan University history professor Anise Strong has written a new book on ancient Rome. Strong says she wrote it in part to document how the word prostitute became used, not just to describe a profession in Rome, but as a way of labeling women.
The point of the book was in particular to sort of try and get beyond this idea that there are these rigid categories of good and bad women, and to really explore some of these stories of these historical figures who fell in between the cracks, who were neither of those, and who led their own rich and fascinating lives and had a lot of influence over the Roman history itself.
WMUK's Andy Robbins spoke with Anise Strong about her book, Prostitutes and Matrons in the Roman World.
Professor Strong, let's start with the title of your book, Prostitutes and Matrons. Those are categories of women that you say in the book were imposed by the men who ran the Roman Empire, but it's not quite as simple as one or the other.
No, it's a lot more complicated than that, both because prostitute we think of fairly straightforwardly as a sex worker, as someone who exchanges money for sex. But in the Roman Empire, it also started to get used for the first time as a moral category, as a bad woman. And so a lot of what the book is about is the way that that label of prostitute as bad woman got applied not just to professional sex workers, but to any women who were stepping outside what elite Roman men viewed as appropriate roles for women who were very active politically or economically.
And you give some examples of women who ran into this, one in particular you introduce in the introduction to the book.
Yes, Vestilia. So the story of Vestilia, who was a real historical figure about exactly 2,000 years ago, is that she was a elite Roman noblewoman, a senator's wife, who was apparently notorious for sleeping around with basically just about everyone in town. And her husband doesn't seem to have had any particular objections to this, but the Emperor Tiberius, who had very much a sort of strong family values platform, as we think of it today, did object to it. And so he put her on trial for adultery, which was a serious crime at that point and had the penalty of exile to a remote island for the rest of your life. Well, Vestilia obviously wasn't thrilled about this, but she took the defense of going down, apparently with dozens of other women who were in similar situations, to what we think of today as the public registrar's office, and registering herself officially as a prostitute. Because under Roman law, prostitutes weren't actually able to commit adultery because sex with multiple people was part of their job. So now she was technically free of the adultery charge, but as you might imagine, the Emperor Tiberius was not really thrilled about this attempt to dodge his law. And so he passed a new law that stated that women of senatorial rank, the noble women, weren't allowed to become prostitutes. And it's fascinating that there is this law, because it really does imply that not just Vestilia, but lots of other women were choosing to at least technically become prostitutes. Unfortunately, things don't end well for Vestilia. He then puts her on trial again because she's now not allowed to be a prostitute, sentences her for adultery, and duly exiles her for the rest of her life.
It's probably worth mentioning that the historical records we have about all of this were, in fact, almost exclusively written by men.
Yes, we have very few sources written by women themselves, and not only by men, but most of them by the elite minority of men who could both read and write and then get their works published.
In your book, you argue that these labels, as you say, were not only descriptive, but also had a moral element, trying to coerce women in particular into acting in certain ways that the men wanted them to. But you also mentioned in the book that unlike some of the other societies around the Mediterranean at that time, ancient Greece, the Near East, North Africa, that women in Rome did perhaps have more influence than they had in those other societies.
No, they had a lot more influence. A lot of that comes, I think, from two things. One, that they were allowed to own property and in most circumstances seem to have managed their finances significantly on their own. And the other is that they were allowed to divorce their husbands if they weren't happy with marriages. And those two things put together mean that, bluntly, you have to pay more attention to your wife if you're afraid that if you behave badly or if you mess up the family finances, she's going to walk off and take your dowry with her. And so that greater prominence, and also I think just generally more cultural respect for women and awareness of women, led to women having significantly more freedoms than the ancient Roman Empire than in many other ancient societies. It's still a very patriarchal society. They still can't vote. They still can't hold political office and so forth.
They couldn't be members of the Senate.
Yeah. But they can, you know, go to school. They can go to the markets by themselves. They can own real estate and advertise it. And they can actually campaign for other people to win election. We have vote for so-and-so graffiti written up by women in Pompeii, for instance.
A question that perhaps a non-historian would ask is, why bother studying studying ancient history and the Roman Empire? What lessons might it have to offer us today?
At the moment, I think tremendous lessons. The biggest one is that it's pretty clear that both the collapse of the Roman Republic into a one-man rule, into a dictatorship, essentially, and then the eventual fall of the Roman Empire itself, that two of the biggest causes there are profound economic inequality. That you go from periods of the Roman Empire where what today we might think of as the middle class are, if not wealthy, able to get along reasonably well, to in both the periods of collapse, there are points where basically you have an increasing population of poor, desperate people who don't see good options in their lives. And they're very isolated from the small upper crust elite who have absolutely ridiculous, fabulous amounts of money and are very out of touch with the lives of the common people. And for pretty much any Roman historian, that means that looking at the modern world today in the modern United States is a little bit terrifying because it makes us really worried about what the effects of growing economic inequality will be in the United States.
So, in fact, the Roman Empire thousands of years ago, 2,000 years ago, is perhaps more modern than we might think it is.
Much more so. I mean, that's not to say that it's modern in every way. I mean, you know, on basic levels, our communication technology has gotten a lot better and so forth. But it is in many ways. And the other thing which reflects on my particular work is that I think the ways that women and men function in society are both in some ways more similar to today, but also have that how the Romans defined what it meant to be a good woman, what it meant to be a bad woman, or for that matter, a good man or a bad man, are models that resonate to the rest of Western history and still very much affect us today.
For a long, long time, centuries, history was, you know, what king ruled from this date to that date and what wars were fought and political stuff and largely about men. That's not been true for a while now as the study of history has broadened to other areas and looked onto other sources. But is it possible at this, you know, great remove in time to put our heads into the heads of a man or woman in ancient Rome?
We can try. It's not always easy, and I often say that it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle when you've only got about 5% of the pieces to work with. So you're trying to imagine what the picture looks like. But we can do so in part by looking at sources like graffiti and personal letters and so on. There are letters that we have that express things as simple as, you know, excitement over going to a birthday party that are not that different from ones you'd see today. And at the same time, there are things that are very different. This is an example from actually the ancient Greek world rather than the ancient Roman, but there's a point in one of the Greek comic playwright Aristophanes plays where a man is asked what is the happiest thing he could imagine. And he says, the happiest thing I can imagine is coming home from work after a long day and my little daughter running up to greet me and me picking up and putting her in my lap and then playing the game where I put coins into my mouth and she fishes them out with her tongue.
That might not be considered appropriate today.
No. And what's sort of shocking about that story is that everyone has a reaction of, oh, what in the world? This is perverted. This is weird. Who has a game of a little girl sticking her tongue into her father's mouth? But if you look at the basic elements, obviously that's not something we do today. But what he's talking about is that what makes him happy is having, you know, enough leisure time to play with his kids and enough money that he can use it casually in a game with his daughter and having an affectionate relationship with his kids, which is very much not different from how someone today might define happiness. But then you get that moment of difference and weirdness in that the specific game that they're playing seems very alien to us.
Perhaps harking to the French phrase, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yes.
Now, you're a professional historian, obviously, but, you know, the ancient world, the Roman Empire in particular, seems to exert a strong pull on the popular imagination. You know, a lot of movies have been made about it. The most recent one kind of bombed at the box office, the remake of Ben-Hur. But not so long ago, there was Gladiator, for example, which was very successful in the box office. Why do you think that in the popular imagination that ancient Rome seems to live on?
So this is actually the other sort of half of my work in many ways, something I'm very interested in. There are a couple of reasons. One is for Americans in particular, I think the idea of this very powerful but also very cosmopolitan and diverse empire is really attractive and interesting. The idea that you could have this empire where there are Jews and Christians and polytheists mingling and people from North Africa and people from Italy and people from the Near East and so forth all interacting with each other is something that you don't get when we're talking about, say, most movies made about medieval England, even though medieval England was more diverse than you see in movies about it. And so I think that's very attractive. But the other thing I think is that in movies and in television, the Roman Empire also often serves as a warning that this is the decadent, oppressive, dangerous empire that we might become if we're not careful. Don't be quite like them. So it's both sort of attractive and appealing, and at the same time, it's also sort of portrayed as this danger sign of where we could go if we become either too imperialist or too decadent by however a particular generation is defining decadent.
It's probably no coincidence that the public architecture in Washington is largely Greco-Roman.
Not at all. The founding fathers and so forth were very interested in Roman history and the Roman Republic. The U.S. Constitution is largely based on it. And certainly the early sort of public architecture was very much meant to evoke Roman and often Roman rather than Greek models, actually, because they viewed the Greeks as a sort of dangerous mob rule rather than what they saw as the more sophisticated rule of the Republic.
We've been speaking with Anise Strong, who's an assistant professor of history at Western Michigan University and also the author of the new book, Prostitutes and Matrons in the Roman World. Thanks so much for coming in and speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was a delight to be here.
Anise Strong spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. Links with more details about her book can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Donald Trump's election as president will have implications for any number of economic, social, and foreign policy issues. Great Lakes Echo commentator Gary Wilson writes that the election results should teach us all to take a break from making predictions about anything, especially if it involves Donald Trump. His column, called Great Lakes: The Trump Effect, instead offers some advice for the president-elect. Gary Wilson, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Gordon. Good to be back with you.
So if you had to make an elevator speech to the president-elect Donald Trump, specifically on the Great Lakes, what would you want to say in the 30 or 40 seconds that you might have with him?
Well, sure, Gordon. Elevator speeches are great because you have to really prioritize. He's going to have all kinds of things coming at him from all different directions, from all different constituencies. But more for the Great Lakes region than the Great Lakes specifically, I would tell him to focus on drinking water quality. This is what I said in the Echo piece. Drinking water quality should be his number one priority. And that goes to the Flint water crisis, which there's no shortage of information for him on that. It's ongoing, and he has been to Flint. And then going back a couple of years, the Toledo water crisis. Now, in Flint, it was its management and infrastructure. In Toledo, it's just taking care of drinking water quality with the algae problems, the toxic algae that is in Lake Erie. So, you know, we're falling behind in this region on basics. We're advancing in some other areas as far as taking care of the Great Lakes, sort of by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That's a whole different topic. But, you know, these drinking water failures are striking, and they're seen from outside the region as just sort of a continuation of the Rust Belt mentality. So I would tell Mr. Trump that those should be his highest priorities.
And as you spell it out there, it's interesting to think about, you know, Flint and Toledo were sort of two different things. So is drinking water quality a little more complex than perhaps it's seen right now? Because most of the focus is on Flint, and if we just replace lead pipes, we'll be fine. But is it a little more complex than that?
Well, I think it's, you know, there's all this attention on Flint as it should be, and Flint deserves as much attention and as many resources as can possibly be directed to that troubled city. Over the weekend, I was reading, you know, various stories about people, you know, Thanksgiving meals and all those wonderful things, and I was reminded in one of the stories that the people in Flint, many of them, still had to make their Thanksgiving dinner using bottled water. But yeah, Flint's problem is an infrastructure problem with lead pipes, and that's really definitely a Great Lakes region problem, but it's a national problem, especially in the older cities. So it's easy to just pigeonhole it as Flint, but it's a national problem. And as far as Lake Erie's water quality, that one, that's a tough one because you've got northern cities in Ohio, and Michigan's part of this too, but it's mainly Ohio. The northern cities, older industrial cities of Toledo and Cleveland especially, who border the lake and take their drinking water from the lake, and have to be on guard against the toxic algae, versus sort of the rest of the state. And Ohio is a big agricultural state, and farmers don't want to necessarily be regulated, which is the ultimate solution for this problem. And President-elect Trump has to deal with both constituencies. The agricultural folks would be sort of a core constituency for him, being, you know, more conservative in nature. But, you know, those many people in those northern cities, you know, were the blue-collar folks who, you know, went against type and voted for Mr. Trump. So he'll have to sort that out.
You noted that, as you've said before on this program, you say it again in this column, that President Obama has been the best friend that the Great Lakes has ever had. And you note a lot of the progress that's been made during his administration. But you also say in this column, smack dab in the middle of that progress is Lake Erie. How come Lake Erie has not enjoyed the same sort of resurgence that the other lakes have?
Well, it's really a tricky one. The states, Ohio, Michigan, Ontario in Canada has a part of this, but it's mainly Ohio and Michigan, and it goes back to my previous point. It's really hard for politicians of all stripes to stand up to agriculture. And in 2011, then EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson spoke to Great Lakes activists in Detroit, and she stated that Lake Erie had just experienced a major algae bloom, and this was before the Toledo water crisis, that algae in general and Lake Erie in particular would be, you know, a high priority for the U.S. EPA. But that never materialized. The EPA, via the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, threw some money at the problem, but it's primarily not a financial problem. And then came 2014 and the water crisis in Toledo, 3 days without water for 400,000 people. In 2015 was a record algae bloom, and I thought that would surely get more attention. But it was just a repeat of past talking points. So that's why I give President Obama low marks in that area. He or his administration just hasn't been willing to take on the agriculture interests.
Now, one thing that you do not address in this column is invasive species. And of course, there's a lot of concern about Asian carp. There has been some debate within the Democratic Party about how that should be handled. If President-elect Trump is looking to do something on the Great Lakes and at the same time perhaps reach across the aisle to some Democrats, could invasive species and Asian carp be one way to do that?
It could, and it's interesting to note, Gordon, one of my readers, Sandy Bin from Ohio, a prominent activist there, took me to task gently for not mentioning Asian carp and invasive species on my recommendations to Mr. Trump. But yes, the ultimate fix for invasive species is broader than just Asian carp. Invasive species go both ways, from the Mississippi to the Great Lakes and back. And what environmentalists definitely want is the physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. And the Army Corps of Engineers did a long, comprehensive study on the feasibility and the cost of doing that. And it's what's probably a 10-year-long process, and it's a multi-billion dollars, somewhere in the $15 billion range, I want to say. Somebody can fact-check me on that. But that's a huge number. But it takes care of a whole lot of infrastructure problems. And Mr. Trump has said along the campaign trail that infrastructure is a priority for him. Now, he hasn't talked a lot about how he's going to pay for all that, but at least it's a priority for him. And that is an area where people could, both sides of the aisle, could get behind it. Everybody knows in this country that infrastructure is a huge problem. Now, conversely, he has to deal with business interests who, in shipping, who may not be all too excited about separating the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. So, like most presidents, he's going to find out that governing is not campaigning.
But, you know, your point there about infrastructure, that has been something he has fairly consistently talked about during the campaign and since winning election. Would water infrastructure be something that we might not think of, you know, at the top of the list, but again, is something that if it got folded into a broader bill could be beneficial to the Great Lakes?
Definitely. I was jotting some notes down this morning, and, you know, pipeline safety is part of the Department of Transportation, and that organization has direct responsibility for pipeline safety. And who knows better than folks in Kalamazoo and the area there how important pipeline safety is. You guys experienced, you know, that significant spill, and still there are some remnants of it around, I believe. And you've got that Straits of Mackinac pipeline, the Enbridge pipeline, that isn't going away, and it's not getting any younger. That needs something done with it, and if not dismantled, needs to be replaced. Pipelines are going to fail at some point the older they get. It's not a matter of necessarily if, it's when. So here's another area where on infrastructure where he could lead, but it's going to take the political will to, you know, challenge some constituencies that have been supportive of him. So we'll have to see what he does.
You say that expectations for President-elect Trump on the environment are low, deservedly so. Explain why.
Well, he's campaigned, one of his favorite whipping boys throughout the lengthy campaign was the United States Environmental Protection Agency. He had harsh things to say about them. He talked about dismantling them, defunding them, doing all kinds of things to the U.S. EPA. Well, the U.S. EPA was, founded in the early 70s by President Nixon, a Republican. And it's enjoyed bipartisan support through all those years, no matter who was the president. Now, some presidents gave it a higher priority than others, but it's an agency that is generally respected on both sides of the aisle, generally thought to do good work on both sides of the aisle, and has never been under such attack by any president. So Mr. Trump comes at it as a candidate that he's going to really take harsh action against the EPA. He feels the regulations have gotten out of control. But what he has to learn is that the EPA enforces the laws, and especially for the Great Lakes region, it's the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act is the most important of those two for the Great Lakes. And those that are laws on the books have been on the books for decades, and they're supported by both parties. So, if he wants to take a hard look at the EPA, fine. If he wants to take a club and an axe to it, I think he's going to get resistance, including from his own party.
Is it fair to say that with President Obama leaving office and with the uncertainty about what President-elect Trump is going to do, that we are about to see a change and perhaps a new era for Great Lakes restoration and how the Great Lakes are viewed by the federal government?
That's a huge question. The Obama administration has funded Great Lakes restoration to the tune of $300 million a year for probably 5 or 6 of the 8 years. In his first year, he got $475 million. Then got caught up in some budget cuts. Paul Ryan is the Speaker of the House. He's from Wisconsin. He's got Lake Michigan in his district. He's never been a big supporter of Great Lakes issues. He's not against them, but he's also doesn't support them. So all that is in play. And If a President Trump wants to go after the EPA, the easiest way to do it would be to cut its budget. I'm going way back, showing my age here, but when President Ronald Reagan, he wanted to get rid of the Education Department. He didn't think it served any value. But rather than just trying to eliminate it, he just cut the budget, so it didn't have a whole lot of money to spend and couldn't do much. And that may be the tactic that a President Trump takes. So that would be a blow to the region, and I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to predict it.
Gary Wilson, as always, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you, Gordon. Thank you.
You can find a link to Gary Wilson's column for Great Lakes Echo, Great Lakes, the Trump Effect, at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.